You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. In Tuesday's presidential debate, former Vice President Joe Biden called on Americans to vote using any available options. President Trump, on the other hand, insisted mail-in voting is rife with fraud. Coming up, we'll look at the pros and cons of voting by mail and how to maintain the integrity of next month's election. Now, the pandemic is a tough time to be a parent for a lot of reasons. Our next guest has been tracking the mental and emotional health consequences for parents and families, in part by asking them how they're doing. She found that a lot of parents are struggling in different ways, but a lot of people also report some positive developments. Margaret Kerr is an assistant professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison and a specialist at the UW Extension. She surveyed parents about their experiences during lockdown in late April and is working on collecting more data now. Maggie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you first surveyed parents back in April. We had the shutdown starting, schools closing. What kind of things were you looking to find out then?
Yeah, so, you know, that was at the beginning of all of this without really an understanding of how long this was going to go on. But all of a sudden, it was a big disruption to parents' daily lives and routines. So parents were either working from home and trying to juggle childcare, which all of a sudden, you know, daycare was not as available, schools were closed, and or they were trying to go to work to their essential job and without reliable forms of childcare. So it was a big disruption, and I wanted to figure out what parents were feeling. That's really what my research surrounds, and this is a time in which parents are just really dramatically affected. And so I wanted to get some understanding of what they were going through, what their mental health looked like, and what their emotional experiences looked like.
On the negative side of things, and there were some negatives, so what were some of the things that struck you most in that initial survey?
The thing that struck me the most is that levels of anxiety and depression in parents were much higher than what we would see in the normal population, specifically about 2 in 5 parents, about 40% of parents reported symptoms of moderate to severe anxiety or depression or both. And that's really high. And then specific to the coronavirus pandemic, 2/3 of parents in the sample reported that COVID has negatively impacted their psychological health. And those are just really big mental health impacts.
What did parents say about ways that they worried anyway about how this is affecting the way they parented, the way they interacted with their kids?
So some of the things that we asked some general questions about what they're worried about. And this is unsurprising. Most parents were worried about their family's health, COVID-19 in general. Most parents were stressed about leaving the house, but also social distancing and having to stay home, which I think puts this whole thing in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. And then we asked them specifically about how their emotions and behaviors were different than how they usually were. So this is not perfect because it's hard. Sometimes in that moment, it's hard to remember what things were like before. But most parents said, about 2/3 said that they were having more worries and anxiety than usual and more anger and frustration than usual compared to prior to the pandemic.
We are talking about how parents are dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic mentally and emotionally and in the ways they deal with their kids. Margaret Kerr is with us from UW-Madison. She's done surveys on these issues, looking at it again. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, what are some of the downsides of parenting during this pandemic? Have you found ways that it's brought you closer together? You can join us at 800-642-1234. If I'm reading your survey right, parents did report some positive things about how they're connecting with their kids. What did we find out?
Yeah, they definitely did. So about almost 60% of parents said they're feeling closer to their children than they felt before the pandemic started. And also that about half said they're feeling more gratitude than they were before. And in addition to that, those just survey measures, we had some open-ended questions. And some of the things that parents reported were that they felt like when slowing down the hustle bustle of day-to-day life, they were able to connect with their kids a little bit more, pay more attention to their schooling than they're able to because they were, you know, literally helping them do it. And to be just a little more in tune with the day-to-day routines of their kids.
Now, this study was back in April, and I remember I, like a lot of other people, a lot of other parents for that matter, was thinking, well, this is going to be a rough couple few weeks. Well, now it's September, and things are getting actually worse here in Wisconsin. As you continue to look at these things and think about them, what do you worry about, given that this is kind of a long-haul situation now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there's this concept called parenting burnout that's been talked about a lot since COVID started. And it's this idea that parents are experiencing chronic parenting stress to the extent that they're don't have the energy to engage in parenting, have sort of a loss of accomplishment in parenting. It's similar to job burnout, but around parenting. And that happens when parents are stressed for a long time. And so one of the things that I worry about, the levels of parenting burnout were not that high in that initial study, but it was really a short-term stressor at that time. And so what I worry about is what is it looking like as parents are still 6 months, 7 months later, trying to manage schooling for their kids while also holding their job or potentially finding a new job at the same time, in addition to the stress about health and things like that. So we're actually collecting, we weren't originally planning to follow up with these participants, but we weren't originally thinking this would be necessary. And so we're going to collect a little bit more data to find out what's going on now.
Now, no parents alive right now, unless they're, I don't know, 120 years old, has parented in a situation like this. Are there lessons we can draw, though, from what we know about parents and mental and emotional health that could help people right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's once we're really able to dive into this data, which we have a little bit, that's what I'm hoping to learn out of this. It's not just what they were experiencing, but who fared better or worse and why. So what are some of the additional things that made this easier or harder? And some of the things that we have found out so far is parents who are able to regulate their own emotions well are doing better, and parents who are able to engage in some coping strategies themselves are doing better. And so what I think some lessons that we can take away from this is that, and this is a lesson that I've been trying to focus on for a while, which is it's really important for parents to take care of themselves. And there's this idea around parenting now that we have to give up everything for our kids, even at the expense of our own needs and wants. And that's not good for parents. And I think this pandemic is illuminating just how not good that is for parents. And so I hope one of the takeaways is helping parents focus on themselves, do things that they need to do to feel rested and rejuvenated and fulfilled.
We're talking to Margaret Kerr, Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison and a specialist at UW Extension. We're talking about the challenges facing parents during the pandemic, especially when it comes to mental and emotional health and how they interact with their kids. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, what has your experience been like? Have you been grateful for more time spent with kids? Have you been feeling overwhelmed? Maybe a little bit of both. What is it that you're finding particularly stressful? Or has something worked for you? Something that's helped you get through all of this that you could maybe share with other parents listening? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Margaret Kerr, Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison. We're talking about her research on the emotions and the mental well-being of parents during the pandemic. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Parents, what have been some of the biggest struggles or maybe wins for you lately? What's your strategy for keeping on, keeping on? If you're busy parenting, maybe that's not why you're not calling in right now. I respect that. But if you have a moment to spare, I'd love to hear your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Maggie, we were talking about parental self-care just a few moments ago, and you asked people about that, the kinds of things they were doing in that late April survey. What did you find out?
Yeah, so the number one thing that parents were doing, which I think is really important, about 70% of parents said taking breaks from news, including social media. I think at the beginning of this, the news was really overwhelming, constantly seeing new information about COVID as it was coming out. And so I think just taking a break to disconnect. And then given the social isolation piece of this, another big thing that parents reported doing was connecting with other people. And that's a part that I think I can't emphasize enough, that it's important. A lot of parents and everyone lost some of their social connections and networks. And so finding ways to stay connected is really helpful for parents.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi.
Hi. I just became a grandma, so I know a lot about stress at this time. So CDC guidelines, you follow the CDC guidelines. You keep busy. You are up to date on your shots. You relax. You find time for yourself and time for your family. And you can keep your faith by watching it on TV until you can go back to church.
Mary Kay, thanks a lot. Congratulations, by the way. Thank you for calling in. So some of the basics there, Maggie.
Yeah, absolutely. And she hit on a point that I meant to mention, which is I think one of the things Mary Kay said, relax. And I think one of the things that parents can really do for themselves is just not try to be perfect right now. I don't think that's anyone's goal. And even if it is your goal, it's just not possible in the constraints that we have. And so if your kid watches a little more TV than you hoped or ate a few more snacks than you hoped, like just relaxing your expectations for yourself.
Thanks a lot for the call, Mary Kay, at 800-642-1234. Yeah, is there something just about the realization that this isn't just a me problem or my family problem? Kind of we're all going through this right now. Just thinking about that could help us cut ourselves more slack, do you think?
Absolutely. There is this idea around self-compassion and kind of for people to resonate in the fact that hard times and suffering is just part of being human. And I think right now there is this profound sense of everyone is struggling in a different way and different people are affected more and differently. But I think there are struggles for everybody. And at least for me, that gives me some I don't want to say peace because it's not great that everyone is having a hard time, but it gives me like a sense of camaraderie and support, knowing that I can go to the people in my life, knowing that they are also going through something that we can talk about together.
Let's bring on another caller now. Jill is with us in Madison. Jill, hi.
Hi. I'm a parent to a middle schooler and a high schooler. And I guess one of my challenges right now, as I'm trying to make one of them some food and in between things, is they're on screens all the time, and I feel guilty because they have to be on screens for school, but then they want to be on screens to see their friends too, because that's the only way to see their friends. And so that's one thing. And ways that I'm trying to cope, my husband and I, we're trying to, you know, get outside, get some exercise. I need some alone time too outside, just to recoup. And we're binge watching Star Trek Discovery. I'll put in a plug for that. So that's helping us get a little break from reality. And so we that's our treat at the end of the day. So
that's fantastic. Jill, thank you so much for sharing all of that with us. First of all, I think we can reassure Jill with the screen time thing. If nothing else, right, she's not alone.
No, that is, yeah, that's what I was going to say. That is just the reality of the situation that we are in. And it's, I want to encourage you not to feel guilty about it, because there's not a lot of other ways around it. And in some ways, the screens allow our kids to still be engaged, in school, to be able to connect with their friends. And if that wasn't there, they wouldn't be able to. And that they're you may not want them to be on the screens all the time, but you do want them to be taking advantage of the opportunity to connect with their friends and to have those social connections that are really important for their well-being.
Thanks a lot for that call. She also mentioned something that I think is important to acknowledge: less alone time. And people in their normal lives might be used to different levels of alone time, depending on their housing situation, how many people in the family and whatnot. But I'm guessing on average, we have a lot less of it now than we might be used to. How big a problem do you think that could be?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And I'm not an expert in that particularly, but I do think there are small moments of alone time that we had that we don't have, like maybe in our car driving to the store or driving home from work. And so I think that it can be a problem, but I also think that it's just an adjustment in the way that we think about our time and how we spend our time. And so finding ways to carve in that alone time differently. Maybe it means a 5-minute walk outside by yourself or a phone call to a friend in another room, but making a more intentional effort to find that space where it might have just been built into our routine before.
Jill, thanks again for that call. We're talking to Margaret Kerr, Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison, talking about mental and emotional well-being for parents during the pandemic. Back to your calls now. Frank is with us in Milwaukee. Frank, hello.
Hi.
What's going on with you, Frank?
Well, thanks for having me on. I heard the first part of the show where, you know, everyone was saying that it was great being home with the kids, and it really is. It was great. We had 2 under 5 at home, and then we had a 3rd at the beginning of March. And it was great being at home, being able to watch them go through steps. But now 7 months later, you know, our 5-year-old's in virtual, and he goes to an immersion school that speaks a different language. So we're in the middle of trying to find someone to help us out at home. Both of us are working, and, you know, so it's just been kind of a roller coaster, you know, with how great it felt. And when the first shutdown kind of went away, I felt a little sad because I knew that I wouldn't have as much time with my kids. You know, so, but now, I mean, it's kind of getting to the point where everything is a little stressed, from school to even just trying to get regular hours at work. So yeah, it's been a roller coaster.
Well, Frank, thank you so much for sharing that. Good luck to you and your family as you try to navigate all this. A roller coaster, Maggie, I'm guessing a lot of people might feel similarly, right?
Absolutely. That's sort of an analogy I use for parenthood in general. I think it's a roller coaster. And so this is just like getting on that new roller coaster at the amusement park that has the higher hills and, you know, the steeper drops, I think is the situation we're in now.
Frank, thanks for calling in. Time for another caller or two. John is with us now in Madison. John, hello.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just kind of wanted to bring up, you know, the social needs of both parents and, you know, the children. I guess for myself, you know, our son has been just dying to see people outside of our household, you know, and just like playing with other kids. You know, he's definitely has gained a bit of weight during this. And, you know, and as a parent, we feel that we can't get away from our kids. And so it's something that, you know, trying to figure out ways to step aside, you know, or step outside of the household or something to just have a breather. But then, you know, your kids are kind of stuck. So I just kind of wanted to point that out and, you know, say that I'm totally grateful that I'm, you know, seeing my kids more. I'm working from home and I'm around them. But it's like, wow, I'm just like, I want to throw this kid through a wall or something.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Again, that upside, the frustration, and that lack of social connection with other grownups sometimes, Maggie, a common theme I think that you're getting in your surveys.
Absolutely. And I just want to speak to that by saying this is like a both and situation. You can feel grateful for having extra time for your, with your kids and knowing that that's a special thing and feeling good about that, and also feel overwhelmed and frustrated and stressed. I think those things can exist at the same time. And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing in the study. And the other thing I would speak to is just the difference between when it first happened. I think that last caller really touched on at the beginning, it was so great. And now it's been 7 months of doing the same thing. And so that's why it's important to look at the data I collected in the context of being in April, which was very different than where we're at and what we might be feeling today.
Thanks again for that call and all your calls. In our last minute or so, Maggie, what are you watching for? What kind of trends are you trying to spot now?
Yeah, I think the things I'm hoping to look at going forward is just how are we going to adapt? How are we going to make this work for parents? How can we support them? And yeah, just what can we do for them going forward? And what is this going to look like? And is it going to change? One of the things I'm hoping to see is maybe some changes in how we approach parenting in general over the long term.
Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Margaret Kerr is an assistant professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison and a specialist at the UW Extension. We talked about parental stress during the pandemic. She did surveys in late April and is working on more now. A few months ago, it was estimated that about half of all votes cast in next month's presidential election could be mailed in. New polling suggests that number may actually be around 35%, still quite a few. Why the decline? NPR cites two primary reasons: recent controversies and concerns involving the Postal Service and President Trump's continued attacks on mail-in voting. He hit on the theme again during his debate with former Vice President Joe Biden earlier this week.
They're sending millions of ballots all over the country. There's fraud. They found them in creeks. They found some with the name Trump, just happened to have the name Trump just the other day in a waste paper basket. They're being sent all over the place. They sent two in a Democrat area. They sent out 1,000 ballots. Everybody got two ballots. This is going to be a fraud like you've never seen.
Is that really the case, though? And if there's significantly less mail-in voting, what does it mean for in-person voting? Let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. Are you planning on sending in your ballot? Are you going to vote at your polling place? How concerned are you about your mail-in ballot being counted successfully? Do you think it's safe and secure or a recipe for problems? What questions or concerns do you have about the integrity of next month's election? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Bob Stein is the Lena Goldman Fox Professor of Political Science and a fellow at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University in Houston. He earned his graduate degrees, by the way, at UW-Madison. Bob, welcome back to Wisconsin and to Central Time.
Well, thank you. And let me make one quick correction. My degrees are from the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee.
Milwaukee. I'm sorry. I had that wrong.
I did take courses in Madison, but give credit to where credit is due.
Absolutely.
UWM.
All right. Well, corrected. Now, looking at what President Trump had said there at the debate and many times elsewhere, do you worry about widespread problems with mail-in voting?
No, I don't. Not regarding fraud. I have been studying this since around 2000, and particularly the president is not referring to, of course, his own mail ballot, because we wouldn't expect the president to engage in fraud. He will be a mail voter in Florida, where they have no excuse mail-in voting, and where he has pointed out you should ask for a ballot and then get it mailed to you. He's complaining about the states like Utah, Colorado, Washington, and of course, Oregon that have had vote by mail, where you're mailed a ballot if you're a registered voter, whether or not you ask for it or not. I've studied those states at great length, and they are far more secure, I should note, regarding their mail-in voting than Florida and other states that have what we call no excuse, but where you have to request a ballot. I do think the president has caused a lot of confusion and a lot of concern about where and when and how people might get a mail ballot and when they should return it. He has objected to something that I think in my state, which is one of the few of Texas that has only excuse only, you have to be 65 or older, disabled or out of the jurisdiction. We're going to see an increase from 8% of vote cast by mail to probably close to 40%. And I am literally looking at survey data. I am working for the county clerk in Harris County, and we have completed interviews with nearly 5,000 voters in Harris County out of the 2.3 million. And we are now identifying between 36 and 40% of those voters who intend on voting by mail. That is, they have already requested a mail ballot. They plan to request a mail ballot. And that is a more than fourfold increase in the number of mail ballots that will be cast in this election. I believe they'll be done carefully and accurately, but our governor just today banned any remote location drop-off boxes. You can now only return your mail ballot by mail or at one location, the county's central vote tabulation at a football stadium where our Texans play.
And you've got some pretty big counties in Texas, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, we have a lot of them. We actually have more counties than any other state in the union, but our county is 254 to be exact, not like your 74, I think, in Wisconsin, range from Harris County, where they're 2.3 million and over 4 million people, to Hudspeth, which might have maybe 800 people and maybe 400 voters. So we have a lot of counties, but I would say probably about 20 of them account for over 60% of what will be the vote. And they're in places like Dallas, Fort Worth, Austin, El Paso, San Antonio, and of course here in Harris County.
Now, you're not worried about fraud, particularly with more mail-in voting. Are you worried about, I guess, a greater risk of some form of glitchiness with maybe voters who aren't used to voting by mail and voting agencies, whatever the local version might be, not used to getting this volume of votes by mail or by drop-off?
Yeah, Barry Burden, a close colleague of mine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I, with another colleague at MIT, Charles Stewart, wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post where we said exactly that. If somebody has not voted by mail before and they're a first-time mail voter, they're much, much more likely to make mistakes in acquiring the ballot, in completing the ballot, and in returning it. And any one of those steps, acquiring, completing, and returning, can lead to an invalid ballot. I am much more concerned that ballots will be ruled invalid, ineligible, not because they're fraudulent, not because somebody intercepted a ballot in a mailbox, not because somebody went to somebody's house and said, I'll return your ballot for you. And then they open it and change the markings that you had made and the choices. I'm much more concerned that evidence is overwhelming that in jurisdictions that see a significant increase in the share of vote cast by mail, voters make mistakes. They don't sign their ballot. They improperly fill in the ballot. I have students who have a hard time doing optically scanned sheets. They don't get their ballot in time, and they fail to return their ballot at the time, at the location that is required by law, and their ballots are invalid. I would say that between those three steps of mail-in voting, they will account for about 99% of all ineligible mail ballots. It will not be fraud. It won't be somebody intercepting the ballot.
Talking to Bob Stein from Rice University in Houston, looking at mail-in voting and the integrity of the election next month. We heard President Trump during the debate on Tuesday. Let's give a listen to his challenger, former Vice President Joe Biden, here defending voting by mail.
Five states have had mail-in ballots for the last decade or more. Five, including two Republican states. And you don't have to solicit the ballot. It's sent to you. It's sent to your home. What we're saying is, they're saying is that it has to be a postmark by the time, by election day. If it doesn't get in till the 7th, 8th, 9th, it still should be counted. He's just afraid of counting the votes.
And that takes us to an issue here in Wisconsin. There have been active court cases on that idea that if you have your ballot postmarked on election day, it can be counted up to a handful of days after election day. Republicans of the state challenging that, Democrats pushing for it. What do you make of some of the legal disputes over our mail-in voting systems around the country?
Well, let's be careful here. I mean, I think it's important to understand what's at issue here. Your state does not allow for what we call aggressive pre-processing of mail ballots. That's a fancy way of simply saying that if somebody hands their ballot in 3 weeks before election day in my state of Texas, we can open, verify, cure, and tabulate, just not release, the results of mail ballots. In Wisconsin, my understanding is you cannot open, verify signatures, and begin to tabulate mail ballots until the day of election day, in the morning,
That's correct.
I believe you doing that. What that means basically is it takes longer to process mail ballots. That's all. If the state requires that a mail ballot be postmarked on the day at 8 o'clock or whenever the polls close on election day, and those ballots are sitting there because the clerk was not legally allowed to open, verify, and tabulate, then it seems perfectly reasonable, as the court, I guess, in your state ruled, that I think it's 6 more days after election day. Of course, the president will make it look like he won on election day and there was fraud. But let me give you a different scenario. Florida and Texas both have pre-processing. At 8 o'clock in the state of Texas on election day, clerks will hit a button and every voter will get to see the total number of votes cast for each of the presidential and everybody else on the ballot from mail and from in person. They won't see the election day ballot totals until probably 10 o'clock as they physically come in from all the voting polling locations. So in states that have pre-processing, the president, who hopes to show that he wins on election night and then claims that these ballots coming in from, you know, the Romulan Postal Service are frauds. But the opposite will happen in states like Michigan, Florida, and Texas, and many others that have pre-processing. Some are not battleground states. Wisconsin, unfortunately, because of the control of the Republicans, will not let the clerks open and verify and cure, not release, any of the mail ballots until election day. The presumption there is that somebody has to watch them do that. There need to be poll watchers. And that's a perfectly legitimate, but it doesn't mean that somebody's mail ballot that was received weeks before election day is somehow invalid because it was sitting there in the clerk's office and not able to be counted by the county clerk and their staff.
Let's bring on a caller now. Juliana is with us in Milwaukee. Juliana, hi.
Hi. I'd like to say that my husband and I are in our 70s, and we have a mail-in ballot that we were going to mail in, but we're going to try to change that and mail in person because we're concerned with no pre-processing in Wisconsin and Trump's apparent efforts to delegitimize mail-in ballots. So we're going to take a chance if we are able to do so and mail in and vote in person.
Juliana, thanks for the call. What do you think about that? People worried about the fate of their mail-in vote, worried about people challenging its legitimacy and deciding, now I'll go back to voting in person, Bob.
They are not by themselves. I am literally looking at data from Harris County, about 5,000 voters, and these are voters we interviewed earlier in July. And we asked them, are you going to vote by mail, in person, early, or on election day? We have the same election options that you do in Wisconsin, just no excuse. And we're seeing now the same voters we talked to in July and August are now telling us, well, I'm over 65. I have a mail ballot, but I think I'm going to try to vote in person. And it's for the same reasons. The president has sowed tremendous doubt, if not in the Postal Service, in the challenge to mail-in voting. And I don't know what to tell that voter to do because I'm not that familiar with the Madison Postal Service. My suspicions are that you'll hear from the Democrats because we know nationally many more Democrats and Republicans are going to vote or want to vote by mail, that they just need to get their ballots in early. But you're absolutely correct that there's a lot of concern. We're seeing a lot of Election Day voters choosing to vote in person early so that they can, how should we say, spread out the vote and the opportunity to contract and spread the virus. But many of the voters who were going to vote by mail are now having, in our state and in our county, a lot of second thought. So again, it's a long time before, I shouldn't say a long time, about 40 some odd days, 43 more days. But I think this is a strategy that the president articulated in the debate on Tuesday night.
It'll only feel like a long time. Juliana, thanks for calling in. Bob Stein is with us talking about mail-in voting and election integrity, professor of political science at Rice University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about voting by mail? What do you think of the president's attacks on voting by mail and claims of the potential for fraud. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about mail-in voting with Bob Stein, political science professor at Rice University in Houston. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts about voting by mail, your hopes and fears for how it will all work out between now and Election Day. How are you voting? Have you changed your mind about how you're going to vote? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Joy is with us in West Bend. Joy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We were intending to have mail-in vote. We got our absentee ballot a couple weeks ago, and then the post office has been sabotaged, so we decided to just take them in. I actually called our township clerk to talk to her about the security of voting, and she suggested bringing it to a slot that they made sure that the slot was not accessible by somebody's arm. So we took ours in like that. But I want to ask about something that's not discussed every time there's a program on the media about voter integrity. Nobody mentions that voting counting machines can be hacked into. The vote count can be changed, and it's not traceable. So what I want to know is, when is that problem going to be solved by our government?
Joy, thanks for the call. Bob, I know people have raised the concern about the hackability of voting machines. How big a concern do you see it as?
Well, I teach with two computer scientists, one who's very eminent, and I would recommend everybody read in the latest issue of Wire magazine, Dan Wallach, who's a professor at Rice, I think shares my view that machines can be hacked, but the bigger concern is not the voting machines, it's the e-poll books. If one wanted to hack and disrupt an election in the United States, because you have over 3,000 jurisdictions, actually closer to 7,000 jurisdictions conducting elections, you would just change a couple of random letters in the names and addresses of voters on the e-book. And as they came in to vote, you would find that they would not match up with their driver's license or other identification. I think it becomes increasingly difficult to hack what would be hundreds of thousands, if not close to a million, whether they're voting machines or even e-slates where people fill out and print out a paper ballot. But the bigger threat, I think, might be to the e-poll books, the registered voter list. Otherwise, we're the only democracy out of 170 that have such a decentralized election system where every, not state, not every county, but every precinct runs an election differently. Poll workers, the machines, and that makes it extremely difficult to hack the voting machines. But I do think that if you wanted to see disruption, you'd see it months before the election, somebody getting a Trojan or some type of virus into the e-poll books, and they would randomly change numbers and letters so that you couldn't, when checking in, match up your name. They wouldn't find your name on the voter list. That's where I suspect. And in the past, 2016, the hacks or the attempts to get in to voting systems were usually the e-poll books or voter registration list.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Bob Stein about mail-in voting and election integrity. Back to your calls now. Phil is with us in Walworth. Phil, hi.
Yes, hello.
What did you want to bring up, Phil?
Yeah, I don't feel that voting in person is any more dangerous than voting or going to a store and buying something. I don't see the argument of safety there. If you feel safe going to a store shopping, you should feel safe going to your polling place and placing your vote.
Phil, thanks a lot for the call. Bob, do you? I know you survey some in your neck of the woods. Do you see people thinking, okay, I might not be as scared to go through the few minute voting procedure on election day now that we've been out, say, shopping in our masks and things like that?
I think it depends on the jurisdiction, the state, whether or not a social distancing and mask is being not only required, but being followed and implemented. My jurisdiction has increased the number of early voting locations from 58 to 121. Our governor has extended early voting by another 6 days. So just like the virus, you can spread it out. And so I think in Texas, and in my own county, in the larger urban areas, I think in-person early voting will be relatively safe. That is to say, you'll have over 100 hours, 13 days, and 121 locations. Voters should be able to find a location, time and day, at which they can vote, where the viral load, where their social distancing will minimize. And I think the gentleman is not incorrect in saying that if you feel comfortable going to a grocery store, it's not so much you feel comfortable there. You can time and choose when and where to shop so as to minimize your exposure. Nevertheless, I think if you're over 60, 65, you have immune problems or other health standing in line at a polling location does risk, and coming into contact with poll workers that might see 100 or more people in a day or shorter period than that might make you want to pause and vote by mail.
Thanks for calling in. We'll go to June now in Baldwin. June, hi.
Hi. I'm not concerned about the ballots, but people, getting your information that you have to have for identification, I feel like many will fill them out incorrectly. So that's where all ballots will not be counted. I am planning to vote in person, and I am concerned about some of the polling places. I have a friend in my book club that told me in Hammond, Wisconsin, she was made fun of by the people working at the polls for wearing a mask. They were not wearing masks. Someone had donated some, and they said they were too uncomfortable. My sister has a beauty shop in Dallas, Wisconsin, and she had a customer come in and say that they were not wearing masks there, and they did make fun of her for wearing a mask. So that concerns me, but I'm not afraid. I vote in a small area that I know I can go in and not be exposed to many people.
So. June, thanks a lot for the call. And June's first point there was something you were raising earlier, Bob, between, you know, witness signatures or voter ID things. There are ways to get your mail-in ballot wrong at the user level.
Yeah. Again, there have been studies. The Election Assistance Commission has studied this since 2000, I think, 8. And as the share of vote cast by mail goes up, there will be errors. And they will not be errors of election administrators and counting or even fraud. They will be errors committed by voters. Like anything, voting is not something we do with regularity. Most Americans will vote once every 4 years. And again, just navigating the voting machine can be a challenge, but taking a paper ballot. One of the good pieces of news, however, is that in most jurisdictions, well over 80%, approaching 90% of voters will complete their ballot with somebody else. And that somebody else will be their spouse, partner, roommate. They have plenty of time. The average voter in a polling location will spend 3.5 minutes completing a ballot. But a voter who votes by mail could spend, you know, 2 or 3 days checking the internet, talking to their friends. None of that would be allowed in a polling location. However, if you make a mistake in a polling location, you can always ask for help and redo your ballot with a poll worker. You make a mistake at home and nobody's catching it and you mail it in, you can invalidate your own ballot.
Bob, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Bob Stein is a professor of political science and a fellow at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University. He got his graduate degrees from UW-Milwaukee. We talked to them about mail-in voting and election integrity. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, Kate kicks off our series of candidate interviews in the November election, starting with congressional candidates in the 1st District in southern and southeastern Wisconsin. It's tomorrow at 8 on the Morning Show. Coming up after the news, environmental advocate Erin Brockovich is worried about water quality in the United States. We'll hear more from her new book and why she says everyday Americans can make a difference. This is Central Time.